Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are doing South Carolina today. I hope you're really looking forward to this. This is where we get into the meat. So I hope you're looking forward to this, and I hope that some of the stuff that we provide you today and in the upcoming episodes will overwhelm you with how clear the ratification debates are in giving us a well-focused look at the terms and definitions of the Constitution. If you can't get better fidelity to understanding what the Constitution really means than what we are going to get into. And so, as you know, this show is sponsored by RepublicReview.org. And this is the only show that provides you this type of academic evidence and gives you the academic-based solutions of what we need to do. It's pretty simple. You've got a comment? We have a comment line, 425-270-5416. Excuse me. And we do ask you that you share this content. We're not talking about the news. I'm telling you, the news will constantly cycle through, and it's not going to get any better. The Biden administration has a mission, and they're on their mission. So don't expect anything. Do not expect anything to stop them or happen unless you get involved. It's that simple. Either you're a part of the problem or you're a part of the solution. And the only solution is getting our state legislatures to step in to protect us. I can't put it any more simpler. They have a responsibility. As Madison put it, they are duty bound to protect us from federal tyranny. How much more does it take? What is it going to take to get you to get involved? We're going to give you the proof. We're going to give you the irrefutable evidence. And so what we're actually going to do, and we're starting off with North Carolina, or not North Carolina, we'll actually be ending kind of with North Carolina. We're starting off with South Carolina. And what I'll probably do is jump into Pennsylvania, then Massachusetts. And the reason we want to go down this path, starting with South Carolina, is because South Carolina met early. However, they didn't ratify the Constitution. They ended up having to have a later session, just like North Carolina. And so they had two sessions. And I don't believe, I'm going to take a gander real quick at the very bottom of this, and I do not believe that they provided any amendments. No, they did not. So I'm correct. They did not provide any amendments, even though Massachusetts had already kind of set that stage. But let me just move straight into the first topic. As I have told you, the Articles of Confederation were defunct. They had failed. And the obligation of the convention was to fix the problem. They knew that the general government in this particular case was not the problem. The problem was the states. The states had failed, and many of the states were going outside the boundaries of the Articles of Confederation. And in this particular statement that is being given by Charles Pinckney, General Charles Pinckney of South Carolina, he identifies how these states had failed and why the necessity of this Constitution. So it's kind of long, so we're going to have to probably take breaks with the different segment breaks. But I want you to understand that when people tell you that this was a runaway convention and there were plenty of people that all in analysis and being honest, they went outside the commissioner or the commissions from their states, they had to. And as a matter of fact, instead of allowing the states to constrain them and protect their cabal, these men recognize their inalienable right to cast off government, or at least to stand up to their state governments, which is what they had to do to actually create a perpetual union. The Articles of Confederation was a failure in trying to create a perpetual union, and what they gave us was actually a constitution for the United States for a perpetual union. They just should have added that and just got rid of the Articles of Confederation title. They should have maintained that perpetual union, just so people could understand that even though this was a brand new government, they had to do this because either that or we would all be speaking French and or some other foreign language, and America would not be what it is today. And I say this, and I'm going to take a second here. If you understand what happened in 1790 was the French Revolution. This constitutional republic wasn't even ratified until 1789. We owed France money. And in the process of setting up this constitutional republic, we actually started paying our debt as the French Revolution was beginning. And we continued to pay our debt and paid our debt in full by the time the Louisiana Purchase came along. Well, okay, so they had this thing called a revolution. That was no big deal, right? I'm here to tell you that Napoleon Bonaparte, with demagoguery, rose to the top of this communist revolution and thwarted the communist takeover of France. But just so you understand, Napoleon Bonaparte was a despot. And had we still owed them, had we failed in the Articles of Confederation, there's no doubt in my mind they would have foreclosed on that debt and came over here and basically conquered us, or would have at least tried, and it would have decimated us. And if they failed, guess what? British would have came right in after them and sealed the deal. Because there were a lot of angst and anxiety, and I'm telling you, Britain was not done. That's why we had to finish the Revolutionary War in 1812. They were continuing to impress our sailors and steal our ships and cargo. Britain was hostile and non-compliant to the treaty that we had already had. So what makes you think that America was safe and that we just, you know, meandered along and kind of stumbled across this thing called the Constitution? It was a godsend. And the only reason that we survived was because of this Constitutional Convention. I am telling you that anybody that points to the convention of 1787 as a runaway convention is only aggrandizing their position so that they can create an argument against the Convention of States, which to me is a weak argument, because the Convention of States has even a weaker argument for saying that we need to amend the Constitution. The fact is, an amendment to the Constitution does not and will not save us. We have to interpose. And so Madison and Jefferson understood this, and this is why they did the resolutions and so forth. And now let's get into these ratification debates so that we actually understand and give you this historical perspective, because this is how it was presented to the delegation of South Carolina. And again, this is General Pinckney, and he says, quote, "It must be recollected that upon the conclusion of the definitive treaty, great inconveniences were experienced as resulting from the inefficacy of the Confederation. The one first and most sensible felt was the destruction of our commerce occasioned by the restrictions of other nations, whose policy it was not in the power of the general government to counteract. The loss of credit and inability in our citizens to pay taxes and languor of government were, as they ever must be, the certain consequences of the decay of commerce. Frequent and unsuccessful attempts were made by Congress to obtain the necessary powers. The states, too, individually attempted by navigation acts and other commercial provisions to remedy the evil. These, instead of correcting, served but to increase it their regulations interfered not only with each other, but in almost every instance with treaties existing under the authority of the Union. Hence arose the necessity of some general and permanent system which should at once embrace all interests, by placing the states upon firm and united ground, enabled them effectually to assert their commercial rights. Sensibility that nothing but a concert of measures could affect this, Virginia proposed a meeting of commissioners at Annapolis from the legislature of each state, who should be empowered to take consideration of the commerce of the Union. Now, so I'm going to take a pause here. Do you know who was at that Annapolis meeting? James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. And so it was Madison's intent to actually rewrite the Constitution, or not rewrite it, fix the Articles of Confederation. Actually, he did have a plan. And what ended up happening was the plan was rejected, and we go through this. And as you know, what ended up happening was they folded the Articles of Confederation into this U.S. Constitution. That's why when you read Federalist Papers 39, 40, 41, and so forth, where Madison actually clarifies that they used the exact same wording of the Articles of Confederation parts of the Constitution. So it wasn't a complete rewrite, but it was a new government and a more effective and effectual government. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me pick up with that last sentence. Sensible that nothing but a concert of measures could affect this, Virginia proposed a meeting of commissioners at Annapolis from the legislature of each state, who should be empowered to take into consideration the commerce of the Union, to consider how far a uniform system in their commercial regulations might be necessary to their common interest, and report to the states such an act as, when unanimously ratified them, would enable Congress effectually the power to provide for the same. In consequence of this, 10 states appointed delegates. By accident or otherwise, they did not attend, only 5 states being represented. The gentlemen present Madison and Hamilton, as I told you, did the gentleman present, not being a majority of the union, did not conceive it advisable to proceed, but in an address to their constituents, which was also transmitted to the other legislatures, acquainted them with the circumstances of their meeting, that there appeared to be, to them, to be other and more material defects in the federal system than merely those commercial powers, that these, upon examination, might be found greater than even the acts of their appointments, than their appointments implied. Was at least so far probable from the embarrassments which mark the present state of national affairs, foreign and domestic, as to merit, in their opinions, a deliberate and candid discussion in some mode which would unite the sentiments and counsels of all states. They therefore suggested the appointment of another convention under more extensive powers for the purpose of devising such further provisions as should appear to them necessary to render the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the union. Under this recommendation, the late convention assembled, for most of the appointments had been made before the recommendation of Congress was formed or known. He thought proper concisely to mention the manner of the convention's assembly merely to obviate an objection, or to remove an objection which all the opposers of the federal system had or had used, that at the time of the convention met, no opinion was entertained of their departing from the Confederation, that merely the grant of commercial powers and establishment of federal revenue were in agitation, whereas nothing could be more true than that its promoter had for the object a firm national government. That was Madison. Madison was a huge driver behind this, and it was he that got Washington to come to this convention, which gave it all of the force necessary. I mean, he was the rock star, along with Benjamin Franklin. Those who had seriously contemplated the subject were fully convinced that a total change of system was necessary, that, however, the repair of the Confederation might, for a time, avert the inconveniences of a dissolution, it was impossible a government that of that sort could long unite this growing and extensive country. They also thought that the public mind was fully prepared for the change, and that no time could be more proper for introducing that than the present, that the total want of government, the destruction of commerce, of public credit, private confidence, and national character were surely sufficiently alarming to awaken the constituents to a true sense of their situation. This is just an excellent, excellent briefing to the delegates in South Carolina. Under these momentous impressions, the convention met when the first question that naturally presented itself to the view of almost every member, although it was never formally brought forward, was the formation of a new or the amendment of the existing. Whatever might have been the opinions of a few speculative men who either did or pretended to confide more in the virtue of the people than prudence warranted, Mr. Pinckney said he would advert to assert that the states were unanimous in preferring a change. They wisely considered that though the Confederation might possess the great outlines of a general government, yet that it was in fact nothing more than a federal union, or strictly speaking, a league founded in paternal and persuasive principles, with nothing permanent and coercive in its construction, where the members might or might not comply with the federal engagements as they thought proper, that no power existed of raising supplies but by the requisitions or quotas on the states, that this defect had almost fatally evinced by the experience of the states for the last 6 or 8 years, in which not one of them had completely compiled, but a few had even paid up their specie proportions, others very partially, and some, he had every reason to believe, had not to this day contributed a shilling to the common treasury since the union was formed. So he's really putting a spotlight on how bad it really was. He should not go into detail of the conduct of the states or the unfortunate and embarrassing situation to which their inattention has reduced the union. This had been so far often and so strongly presented by Congress that he was sure that there could not be a member on the floor acquainted with them. It was sufficient to remark that the convention saw and felt the necessity of establishing a government upon different principles, which instead of requiring the intervention of a 13th different legislature between the demand and compliance, should operate upon the people in the first instance. He reported that the necessity of having a government which should at once operate upon the people and not upon the states was convinced to be indispensable by every delegation present, that however they may have differed with respect to the quantum of power, no objection was made to the system itself. Now, if you understand that the Continental Congress was really, you know, put together by the states, what this new Congress was going to do was going to have a harmony of the Senate put together by the states, and the House of Representatives was going to be put together by the people, thus creating a new paradigm shift in the general government of having a true bicameral government, not like the bicameral government in Britain, which was just a House of Representatives where they didn't have the states, where the states had their own influence within the government. Anyway, they considered it, however, highly necessary that in the establishment of a constitution possessing extensive national authorities, a proper distribution of its powers should be attended to, sensibly of the danger of a single body, and that to a such council the states ought to not entrust important rights. They considered it their duty to divide the legislature into two branches, and by limited revisionary power to mingle in some degree the executive in their proceedings, a provision that was pleased to find meets with universal approbation. The degree of weight which each state was to have in the federal council became a question of much agitation. The larger states contended that no government could long exist whose principles were founded in injustice, that one of the most serious and unanswerable objections to the present system was the injustice of its tendency in allowing each state an equal vote with notwithstanding their striking disparity. The small ones replied, and perhaps with reason, that as the states were the pillars upon the general government, must ever resist, their state governments must remain, that, however they may vary in point of territory or population as political associations, they were equal. This right here lays down the tenor or the tone and the ultimate message that every state in this union has equal footing. And this was the intent of the framers. Why is that important? Because it didn't take long for the federal government to start changing the equal footing doctrine, where the federal government started dictating to states that we're only going to give you these things, we're only going to give you this land, and so forth. So moving on, that upon these terms they formally confederated, and that no inducement whatsoever should tempt them to unite upon others, that if they did it, would amount to nothing less than throwing the whole government of the Union into the hands of three or four of the largest states, which would have been Virginia, Massachusetts, probably North Carolina, and probably either Pennsylvania and or New York. After much anxious discussion, for had the convention separated without determining upon a plan, it would have been at this point a compromise was effected by which it was determined that the first branch be so chosen as to represent in due proportion the people of the Union. that the Senate should be the representatives of the state, where each should have an equal weight. Though it was at first opposed to this compromise, yet it was far from thinking in one injudicious one. I'm sorry. The different branches of the legislature being intended as checks upon each other, it appeared to him they would be more effectually restrained in their mutual intemperances under this mode of representation than they would have done if both houses would have been so formed upon proportional principles. And we will cut it off there. We'll be right back after these two promos. Hope you're enjoying this. This is good stuff. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me just take off right where we left off. So kind of ended up on proportional principles. For let us theorize as much as it will be impossible so far to divest the majority of the federal representative of their state views and policy as to induce them always to act upon truly national principles. Men do not easily wean themselves of those preferences and attachments which country and connections invariably create. And it must be frequently have happened had the larger states acquired that decided majority, which a proportional representation would have given them in both houses, that state views and policies would have influenced their deliberations. The ease with which they would, upon all occasions, have secured a majority in the legislature might, in times less virtuous than the present, have operated as temptations to designing the ambitions of men to sacrifice the public good to private views. This cannot be the case at present. The different mode of representation for the Senate will, and has already been observed, most effectually prevent it. The purpose of establishing different houses of legislation was to introduce the influence of different interests and principles, and he thought that we should derive from this mode of separating the legislature into two branches those benefits which a proper complication of principles is capable of producing, and which must, in his judgment, be greater than any evils that may arise from their temporary dissensions. The judicial he conceived to be at least the most important and intricate part of the system, that a supreme federal jurisdiction was indispensable and cannot be denied. Now, I'm just going to put it in here and just add to this that when you look at the powers that the federal government is supposed to have, having the judiciary residing in the states would be able to constantly protect themselves. This is why during the debates it became very important regarding jurisdiction. And this is why we're going to prove to you that the jurisdiction of the federal courts, John Marshall even says this, so we'll get to it, in the Virginia ratification debates. And you know who John Marshall was. He became the Supreme Court Chief Justice. That jurisdiction was limited to the enumerated powers. If something came to the court, or if the federal government created a law that was not within the enumerated powers, the court, as the guardians of the Constitution, would consider it void and basically tell the government that you cannot create those laws. Well, they're not doing that, but they kind of started off that way. And over time, and actually Marshall was the one, because he was a protege of Alexander Hamilton, Marshall was the one that aggrandized the court's powers. But anyway, let me move on to Mr. Pinckney's address. It is equally true that in order to ensure the administration of justice, it was necessary to give it all the powers original as well as appeal it. The Constitution has enumerated without it, we could not expect a due observance of the treaties, that the state judiciary would confine themselves within their proper sphere, or that the general sense of justice pervade the Union, which this part of the Constitution is intended to introduce and protect. That much, however, would depend upon the wisdom of the legislatures who are to organize it, that from the extensiveness of its power, it may be easily seen that under a wise management, this department might be made the keystone of the ark, the means of connecting and binding the whole together, of preserving uniformity in all the judicial proceedings of the Union, that in republics, much more in time of peace, would always depend upon the energy and integrity of the judicial than any other part of the government, that to ensure these extensive authorities would necessary, particularly so, in a tribunal constituted as this is, whose duty it would be not only to decide all national questions which should arise within the Union, but to control and keep the state judicials within their proper limits whenever they shall attempt to interfere with its power. And the executive, though not constructed upon those firm and permanent principles which he confessed would have been pleasing to him, is still as much as to the present temper and genius of the people will admit. Though many objections had been made to this part of the system, he was always at a loss to account for them, that there can be nothing dangerous in its powers, even if it was disposed to take undue advantages, must be easily discerned from the reviewing them. He is commander-in-chief of the land and naval forces of the Union, but he can neither raise nor support forces by his own authority. He has a revisionary power in the making of laws, but if two-thirds of both houses afterwards agree, notwithstanding his negative, the law passes. He cannot appoint to an office without the Senate's concurring, nor can he enter into treaties, or in short, take a single step in his government without their advice. He is also to remain in office but 4 years. he might ask them, from whence are the dangers of the executive to proceed? It may be said, from a combination of the executive and the Senate, they might form a baneful aristocracy. Anyway, that kind of summarizes, and he goes on actually a little further, but the next point that I want to pull out of his address is the powers that are delegated. And so this is what Mr. Pinckney says just a little bit later. As a matter of fact, it is in the next paragraph at the very end. He says, all power being immediately derived from the people and the state governments being the basis of the general one, it will easily be in their power to interfere and to prevent its injuring or invading their rights. Though at first he considered some declaration on the subject of trial by jury in civil causes, the freedom of the press necessary, and still thinks it would have been as well to have it inserted, yet he fully acquiesced in the reasoning. So he's just kind of pointing out things that they felt were important with the Bill of Rights, right? Freedom of the press and the trial by jury and those types of things. In the reasoning, which was used to show that the insertion of them was not essential. The distinction which has been taken between the nature of a federal and state government appeared to be conclusive, that in the former, no powers could be executed or but such as were expressly delegated. So right here, he basically says that in the federal government or the national government or the general government, they couldn't execute any power but those that were expressly delegated. That indefinite power was given to the government except on points that were by express compact reserved to the people. So in other words, here he lays out the same argument that we're going to hear in all of the other states, that the general government had delegated powers. They did not have general powers. They were enumerated and specific. So a little bit later on, he gets into the militia and actually talks about the militia in this exact same address, and it happens to be in the next paragraph at the very end. We may be told a free government imposes no restraint upon the private wills of individuals, which does not conduce in a greater degree to the public happiness. But all government is restraint and founded in force. We are the first nation who have ever held a contrary opinion or even attempted to maintain one without it. The experiment has been made, and he trusted that there hereafter by a few men weak enough to suppose that some regular force ought not to be kept up, or that the militia ever can be depended upon as the support and protection of the Union. So he basically was just pointing out that the necessity of the militia was actually tied directly to the greater degree to the public happiness. Okay, so now we're going to kind of move into some other comments and other, I'll just say, assertions. And this one is by Mr. Pierce Butler regarding war. He was one of the delegates of the Federal Convention. So in other words, he was in Philadelphia. So what he's going to be telling you is an assertion of how this stuff was defined. He was one of the committee that drew up this very particular clause and would endeavor to recollect those reasons by which they were guided. It was at first proposed to vest the sole power of making peace or war in the Senate, but this was objected to as inimical and whatever we want to consider inimical, that would be hostile. So in other words, I'll just put hostile in there. But this was objected to as hostile to the genius of a republic. Okay, so we'll pick it up right where we left off, right after this promo, or these two promos coming up. We're really getting into the meat, and I hope you're actually starting to see, you know, how things are being defined here. We will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what is actually going to happen is that Mr. Pierce Butler, or Major Pierce Butler, is going to make a comment regarding, you know, the declaration of war and kind of talk about how it was handled in the convention. Then General Charles Coatworth Pinckney is going to stand up, you know, and following exactly what he just said, and provide better clarification and go into other details on the subject. So let me start all over again. So Major Butler was, again, one of those of the committee, and was one of the committee that drew up this clause and would endeavor to recollect. And so I want you to garner what the scribes are doing is, instead of actually just kind of recording, they're actually talking. That's why they say he thought, he subjected, or, you know, he asserted, or what have you. They're kind of summarizing, but they're actually identifying what they were saying. And so this is why the vernacular, it doesn't seem like just a person speaking. It's more of a person that is accounting for what this person is saying. And so anyway, Major Butler, the scribe basically says, Major Butler was one of the committee that drew up this clause and would endeavor to recollect those reasons by which they were guided. It was first proposed to vest the power of making peace or war in the Senate. But this was objected to as hostile to the genius of a republic. By destroying the necessary balance they were anxious to preserve, some gentlemen were inclined to give this power to the president, but it was objected to as throwing into the hands and influence of a monarch. Having an opportunity of involving his country in a war whenever he wished to promote her destruction, the House of Representatives was then named, but an insurmountable objection was made to this proposition, which was that negotiations always required the greatest secrecy, which could not be expected in a large body. The honorable gentleman then gave a clear and concise opinion on the propriety of proposed constitution. This is when the general stood up and came forward, and General Charles Coatworth Pinckney observed that the honorable judge, from his great penetration had hit upon one of those difficult points which for a time occasioned much debate in the convention. Indeed, this subject appeared to be so much magnitude that a committee consisted of one member from each state was appointed to consider and report upon it. His honorable friend, Major Butler, was on the committee for this state. Some members were vesting powers for making treaties in the legislature, but the secrecy and dispatch, which are so frequently necessary in negotiations, evinced the impropriety of vesting it here. The same reason showed the impropriety of placing it solely in the House of Representatives. A few members were desirous that the president alone might possess this power and contend that it might safely be lodged with him, as he was to be responsible for his conduct, therefore would not dare to make a treaty repugnant to the interest of his country. And from his situation, he was more interested in making a good treaty than any other man in the United States. This doctrine, General Pinckney said, he could not acquiesce in. Kings, he admitted, were in general more interested in the welfare of their country than any other individual in it, because the prosperity of the country tended to increase the luster of his crown, and a king could never receive sufficient compensation for the sale of his kingdoms, for he could not enjoy in any other country so advantageous a situation as he permanently possessed in his own. And kind of skip forward, at least it was agreed to give the president a power of proposing treaties, as he was the ostensible head of the Union, and to vest the Senate, where each state had an equal voice, with the power of agreeing or disagreeing to the terms proposed. This, in some measure, took away the responsibility, but not totally, for, though the Senate were to be the judges on impeachments, and the members of it would not probably condemn a measure they had agreed to confirm. Yet, as they were not a permanent body, they might be tried hereafter by their senators and condemned if they deserved it. Now, when they say by their senators, it was talking at that point of their state senators. Now, to be clear, the states, many of the states, and as a matter of fact, South Carolina, only had a unicameral legislative body. They did not have a bicameral legislative body. But after the Constitution and after its ratification, every state started reforming into the same mode as the national government, offering representation at the counties for each Senate, for a Senate seat, as well as by apportionment, representation for the people. We've completely lost this, and we get into this, you know, through different content and different measures, but bottom line, American republicanism was born via this constitutional debate of 1787. On the whole, back to Mr. Pinckney, on the whole, a large majority of the convention thought this power would be more safely lodged where it had finally vested it than anywhere else. It was a power that must be necessarily be lodged where political caution and Republican jealousy rendered it improper for us to vest it in the president alone. The nature of the negotiation and frequent recess of the House of Representatives rendered that body an improper depository of this prerogative. The president and the Senate joined were, therefore, after much deliberation, deemed the most eligible corps in whom we could safely vest the diplomatic authority of the Union for treaties. Now, as we know, Congress combined has the power to declare war. But the treaties, and you got to understand that the president and the Senate going in before a war could actually take place, because sometimes the war can break out because the treaty has been violated. So nine times out of ten, every nation, when you know they first start working, they create treaties and so forth. And when treaties get violated, that tends to lead to war. But they took away the power of declaring war from just the Senate and the president. It requires Congress to declare war. So anyway, let's move forward. One of the things that I am going to highlight is slavery, especially out of the South Carolina debates here, because they talked about it the most. And so I want to make sure, this was still the same day. So this was Wednesday, January 16th, 1788. The Honorable Rawlins Loudons was the one that was speaking, and this is where he basically made comments regarding slaves. He believed the gentleman that went from this state to represent us in convention possessed as much integrity and stood as high in point of character as any gentleman that could have been selected. And he also believed that they had done everything in their power to procure for us a proportionate share in this new government, but the very little they had gained proved that we may expect in future that the interest of the northern states would so predominate us as to divest us from any pretensions to the title of a republic. In the first place, what cause was there for jealousy of our importing Negroes? Why confine us to 20 years, or rather, why limit us at all? For his part, he thought this trade could be justified on the principles of religion, humanity, and justice. For certainly, to translate a set of human beings from a bad country to a better was fulfilling every part of these principles, but they don't like our slaves because they have none themselves, and therefore want to exclude us from this great advantage. Why should the southern states allow of this without the consent of 9 states? And so, obviously, here is a Mr. Rawlins Loudons is basically coming out and saying that he felt that it was disingenuous and that the Union should have allowed. So anybody that tells you, the reason why these things are important is that here they're complaining because they realize that the Constitution was created to create a disadvantage, even though states had the right for, you know, their own destiny, and that slavery was a state issue, not a federal issue. However, anybody that says that the convention and the Constitution turned its back on this inhumane and immoral practice, they're lying to you, because here these men are identifying how the Constitution actually is perpetuating in essence, the Civil War, because by shutting down the slave trade, it was going to force an alignment or an advantage, let's just say an advantage for the Northern and the abolition movement, to where more states would actually be able to enjoy. And if you understand the Northwest Ordinance, which was actually adopted by Congress, even though the Continental Congress ratified it in October, it was actually, I believe it was August of 1789, that they actually brought it in as a part of the same laws that the Continental Congress had created. In the Northwest Ordinance, they ended slavery. We'll get in more into this topic when we come right back in our next episode regarding slavery. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.